Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, our relationship with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Jeremy Jackson. He is, among other things, a professor emeritus at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and co-author of the new book called Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crisis. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start here with respect. The book is broken into basically three parts. And the first part is called Heartland. And actually, the book kind of reads like a road trip, a buddy trip that you and co-author Steve Chappell took, starting in the Mississippi watershed. And talk about what the intention was with that trip down the Mississippi.
Well, you know, it's very easy as a scientist or a journalist to sit in our offices and write about the doom and gloom of things that are changing in the planet. But it's another thing to actually go out and talk to the people in the places and get to know them and sort of see for oneself what's going on. So the purpose of that trip, we had a deep sense from the beginning that we really were in a time of very rapid change, that things were deteriorating very quickly, that climate change was now, but we just wanted to go out and see for ourselves. And so we chose to go to really the two of the iconic regions of American prosperity, the Corn Belt in the northern Mississippi area, and the oil and gas, at the Delta and the mouth. And so that's what we did. And two sort of East Coasters spent a lot of time in the Midwest.
Yeah, well, here's one fascinating thing I read about corn in general in this country, that only about 1% of all the corn that is grown in this country is actually kind of the sweet corn variety that we consume. The majority of it, well, close to 99% of it, goes to what I might describe as feed, fuel, and fructose.
Yeah, and put fuel at the top of the list.
Yeah.
It's an amazing boondoggle. It's the whole ethanol, what I think of as a scam, to produce this fuel as a measure against global warming, but in fact, you really have to look very carefully at the efficiency of the production of the ethanol from corn to see whether or not it is resulting in a net loss in carbon emissions, and it's pretty dicey. If we wanted to grow something to make ethanol, we'd be better off with sugarcane, or we can get the same kind of productivity just from natural prairie grass,
right?
Without all the fertilizer and
right.
insecticides and herbicides that go with it. It's quite remarkable how little of the production of the Midwest goes to our stomachs or the stomachs of anybody else.
Right, and you mentioned the other F word in there is fertilizer. And so now let's turn our attention to the impacts, not just, like you say, fertilizer, but pesticides has on the watershed, the river as it flows downstream.
Well, you know, when we started out, I'm a marine scientist, so I was particularly interested in what's called the dead zone
right.
at the mouth of the Mississippi River, which is, we now know definitively, the result of mostly nitrogen, but to some extent phosphorus, nutrient pollution that accumulates from all of that agriculture in the Corn Belt region. What I hadn't realized was the extent of the dead zone in Lake Erie that results from the inflow of excessive amounts of nutrients into that lake, and to a lesser extent the other Great Lakes. And the consequence is explosions of cyanobacteria that are extremely toxic. And you may remember the drinking water of Toledo, Ohio, was shut down for 2 or 3 days a few years ago because of one of these toxic blooms. And it's a pervasive problem throughout the northern Midwest, and many reservoirs and aquifers for drinking water in that region have above danger levels of cyanotoxin in the water from the blooms of these cyanobacteria.
So stepping back a little bit, what form did your trip take as you were kind of following this path? You know, how did you decide where to go, and how much of it was planned in advance, and how much was kind of on the fly? I'm curious about how you made those decisions.
Oh, serendipity rules. Yeah. I mean, you know, and we would never have been as successful, I think, as we were if it weren't for the fact that Steve Chappell, my co-author, is a veteran journalist, and his ability to find people and ferret out stuff is just remarkable. So we knew we wanted to go to the Corn Belt, and we knew we were interested in ethanol, so we wanted to go to an ethanol plant, you know, and we knew we needed to find a farmer. John Weber, who is the first chapter in the book, and who is a lovely person, by the way, who really just took a lot of time for these two geeky guys from the opposite coast. We found out about him through a third-hand connection of a real estate guy Steve knew in La Jolla, California. And so we just followed up, you know. And all those other farmers, the guy who actually grows the exquisite-tasting corn that people do eat, and these two Christian organic farmers, we found them just by word of mouth and driving around and following up on hunches. In the Delta, though, we just found this great guy, Foster Kreppel, who runs an inn right down, way down on the Delta, and he connected us to everybody. He was wonderful.
So let's focus now on the Delta, the Mississippi Delta. And the dead zones you talk about, they seem to be getting larger every year, and maybe starting earlier and lasting longer, per se?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's there to stay until we stop dumping, farming as sloppily as we do. We allow all that nutrient to run off the fields. I don't think most people realize that most agricultural fields are what is called tiled. Hmm. The term comes from the days of the Roman Empire when they used clay tiles to make conduits under fields to promote drainage. Now we do it with rubber PVC piping, but it's the same idea. Hmm. We could capture the nutrients out of the water that drain off the fields, but it's a little bit expensive, so people don't bother to do it. They also plant right up to the margins of creeks, and instead of planting, leaving buffer zones of natural vegetation to trap the surface runoff of the nutrients. And so the net result of this is that the Mississippi River is a spigot of nutrient pollution that runs into the Gulf of Mexico. And the dead zone, New Jerseyans hate it, but it's about the size of New Jersey, except when it's bigger in New Jersey, and it lasts for several months. And it what it means is that all this organic production results in the sucking up of the oxygen from the water, and anything that can't get out of Dodge dies from lack of oxygen. So you get these huge fish kills and crab kills, and it's gross.
Right, and of course it has an economic impact to the fishery industry down there.
Yeah, it does. Actually, it wasn't as severe as I expected to be, but it has forced everybody to go further offshore, which means they spend more money on fuel, and they're already fishing at the economic margins, really. And then, for shrimp, that's diminishing. Oysters are diminishing. So it's bad news for the fishers, and the dead zone is a major contributor to that bad news.
So you see all of these issues, these problems as you are traveling together. But you seem to maintain kind of a hopeful viewpoint. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I guess, you know, from the very start, I used to be known as Dr. Doom and Gloom when I was doing lots of lectures about the absurdity of overfishing in this country and globally. But, you know, that why keep that up? I mean, there's so many doom and gloom books around. The purpose, really, of our project was to see how bad it was, but also to seek out situations where people are doing the right thing and where it's getting better. And there are a lot of examples of that, you know. And so the latter half of the book, after the road trip, is to really dig in and look at water issues and agricultural issues and climate change and see the good, the bad, and the ugly of all those things. And from the point of view of sea level rise and hurricanes, there is no good news. I mean, look at what's happening right now today. Right. The evacuation of 1.5 million people from the Carolinas. My guess is that that number will increase dramatically. That is going to be a terrible hurricane, and for all the reasons that scientists have been predicting all along, it's going to be another Harvey. What was sort of a middling storm encounters a big pool of hot water. Why is it hot? Well, because of global climate change. And hurricanes are heat engines.
Right.
So it hits that hot water, man, and boom, Harvey went from a middling tropical depression to a Category 3 hurricane in a day and a half. Right. And then we all know what happened. And Florence is going to be the same. So, you know, in some aspects, it's really scary. It's going to get worse. And we're just going to have to adapt. We're going to have to move cities to higher ground. We're just going to have to face reality. But in most other issues of water management and agriculture, there are very clear solutions, and we're just not pursuing them because it's a little more expensive or because the people who are making all the money, like DuPont and Monsanto with Roundup ready, you know, crops, they don't want to change because they're doing really well. Thank you very much.
Right. We're speaking with Jeremy Jackson. He is the co-author, along with Steve Chappell, of the new book called Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises. So let's talk a little more about adaptation and how the different forms adaptation takes with respect to, let's say, sea level rise. And also I want to talk a little bit about this term breakpoint too, because I think they might be interrelated. But, well, let's start with that. What do you mean by breakpoint with respect to this?
Well, point? You know, it's very similar to the notion of a tipping point.
Yeah.
You know, you build up, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back syndrome. You keep adding more and more straw, and everything looks the same, and then boom, the back breaks. I like breakpoint rather than tipping point because it's actually a mathematical notion which very precisely describes this switch from one state to another state where, in effect, the rules change because you've gone over the edge. And that's certainly what we're seeing with the strength and frequency of these very strong storms. It's what we're seeing with extreme weather generally, which is a huge problem across the country. And it's, you know, we used to talk about the flood of the century, but now the flood of the century happens every 2 to 3 years.
Right.
Along the Mississippi River. That's sort of just a basic change. The water temperature in the Northwest Atlantic is the anomaly. It's something like 3 to 7 degrees warmer than the previous 20-year average. these very sharp changes. And they tend to be the result of positive feedbacks where changes reinforce themselves and they become sort of runaway phenomena. That's what's happening with global warming. You know, as the ice disappears in the Arctic Ocean, it goes from being white to effectively black. That means that huge areas, increasing areas, no longer reflect the sun's energy back. They absorb it as a black body. That makes the seawater rise, temperature rise even faster, which melts more ice, which makes more black water to absorb more heat, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. And it just runs away. And so breakpoint is really epitomizes or defines that kind of switch where we go into an entirely different set of rules, the way the world works.
Well, let's say out west here, you could look at ongoing drought or longer and more intense droughts, and then
absolutely,
and longer.
Even in the Central Plains, I mean, the story in the Southwest, of course, is extreme, and
yeah.
The groundwater depletion, for example, is stunning, and you've probably seen photographs of Lake Mead and Lake Powell, where the walls of the canyons are bright white because of the extraordinary drop in the level in those reservoirs. It's likely to stay, and I would say in places like Utah, you may be in more trouble than California, which will still get the rain, punctuating the extreme droughts, but they'll get it, and it's not clear, I don't think, yet, whether you're likely to get it in the mountainous areas of the Rockies. So, yes, the extreme drought, all the projections are for much more severe drought lasting much longer, and we're sure as hell not going to be growing lettuce in the deserts of Arizona and eastern California in a while.
Right. There is that knock-on effect, that drought results in increased fire seasons, more intense fires, which changes and biodiversity changes, the bark beetle. Everything is linked.
Everything is linked. And it's, I mean, I'm from the East, and I retired back to the East, but I spent a lot of time in California at Scripps, and I really grew to love it, and I grew to admire the incredible bravery of California in its measures to counteract climate change. And then you see, for all that good action, you see the consequences of the fires in Northern California, and it's terrifying.
Right.
And that's going to be like every year.
So we have a few more minutes. I want to go back to this hurricane in terms, again, of adaptation and resiliency. I lived for 8 years in South Florida, and I experienced three different hurricanes, maybe Cat 1, Cat 2.
Yeah,
nothing like
this.
Yeah, I
grew up there in the 1950s.
All right, so you see tremendous change down there. But I think there's a breaking point that has to be acknowledged with respect to this attitude we have along the coastal communities of we can rebuild and we can come back.
Yeah, well, that's
changing.
Okay. And that's one of the real signs of hope. And in the book, you know, we have a map where we show the alternatives for New York City.
Yes.
And New York City has high areas and low areas. And there are ways of dealing with it, which they're slowly but seriously starting to engage in. Natural barriers like oyster reefs, levees where you have to build them, but also the realization that, you know, southern Manhattan is going to go sometime.
Right.
So there's a very rational discussion going on in New York about how to plan. Now, that's in contrast to the denialism in Florida, where, and North Carolina, ironically, with Florence bearing down on them, where the legislatures made it illegal to talk about climate change in government buildings.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, but people are getting it. And right next to Mar-a-Lago in Florida, the good citizens on the coast have a very different attitude about climate change because their front lawns are starting to get flooded by salt water every full moon high tide.
Right. Sunny day
so
flooding.
I mean, that was really the point of the epilogue in the book, to identify the increased reality in thinking about these issues, which is popping up all over the country in spite of the attitude of the federal government at this time, and the electrifying, rapid, accelerating shift to renewable energy in large parts of the country is an example of that. So I think we're going to get there.
Okay.
But I think there's going to be an enormous amount of pain along the way, and certainly for the East and Gulf Coasts, the sea level rise issue isn't going to go away, and we are going to have to really rethink. There are 300 cities and towns along those two coasts that are going to lose more than half of their homes underwater by the end of the century.
Right. And this is going to be a fascinating storm, because I believe that if it does hit as a Category 4, you may see some permanent changes to the Hatteras coastline. And communities may have to rethink about where people can rebuild.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's another good sign. It's already happened on the Outer Banks, where you can't get insurance anymore, not even from the federal government.
Right.
So if you're a bazillionaire and you want to build a house and you shrug off the fact that the hurricane destroyed it, that's fine. But if you are struggling, you don't want to live there because nobody's going to help you rebuild. And that's not the case everywhere, but it's increasing. Insurance companies are abandoning Florida.
Right.
And many of these vulnerable coastal areas. And we're going to, as a nation, we're going to have to help people move, you know? I mean, if the big one hits Miami, we're going to see the evacuation of that city.
Right. I'm sorry, it's a fascinating book. We gotta wrap up, and I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Oh, well, I really appreciate you're talking to me, and it makes me feel very good that you loved the book and thought it was worth talking about.
That's what we do on this green earth. That's what we're all about. The name of the book is Breakpoint: Reckoning with America's Environmental Crisis. Jeremy Jackson and Steve Chappell, the co-authors. Again, Professor Jackson, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Let's